Hello and welcome to the yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 23rd of October 2016. My name is T.R.P. Watson and this week I'm joined by Nick from Past Obstructed View, Johnny Fox, Phil from Western Whingers and Gareth James. We're now going to talk about shopping and fucking at the Lyric Hammersmith. This is Mark Ravenhill's 1996 play, directed here by Sean Holmes, with a design by John Bowser and Tal Rosner. It stars Alex Arnold as Robbie, Ashley McGuire as Brian, David Morst as Gary, Sam Spruill as Mark, and Sophie Wu as Lulu. If you recognise the male names from somewhere, yes, they are the first names of five of the members of Take That. For some reason, I think they missed out Jason Orange, which he must be very upset about. This play was originally directed at the Royal Court when it was hanging out in the West End by Max Stafford Clarke, and this production marks its 20th anniversary. Nick, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
Actually, I'm not sure whether Howard Donald should be offended that you forgot him as well, whereas they did include Lulu. So I'm not sure how the whole naming it after Take That thing works, given that he's included a Brian instead of Howard or Jason. Maybe it's Brian Harvey. Maybe it's E17, because Brian's obviously a evil outside force. Yeah, to be honest, I'm not sure how the whole Take That thing works on this. So this is a play that's often referred to as being very prescient of how the world was becoming completely consumer-driven and money-driven. And it's about three people who sort of live together. There's the couple who are Lulu and Robbie, and they live with a slightly older man, Mark. And the way it's described in the play is that he owns them, that he bought them for £20 off some bloke in a supermarket who was bored of them. And there's certainly a dependency there. Everybody seems very happy with the arrangement, and the couple are very dependent on him. Where the kind of story part of it, if there is really a story to it, comes in, is the fact that Mark is a drug addict and he has to go to rehab for a few months. So the other two kind of have to find their own way, which sort of is a combination of Lulu tries to get a job at selling on a shopping channel. And that's where Brian, who's been gender flipped here, and Ashley McGuire kind of plays a bit, not very much, but does kind of acknowledge, because I'm not sure even the name Brian gets mentioned much in the script. So I think people who didn't look at the cast list might not realize that she was actually playing a man, but she does kind of do little nods to it occasionally. Brian's supposed to be interviewing her for this job. He actually ends up using her as a drug dealer to push ecstasy tabs in a club, which goes very wrong when Robbie gets involved. And they also try to make their money through it being still kind of the 90s here. It's sex phone lines. Meanwhile, when Mark gets out of rehab, he doesn't want to go back to them because he thinks that being emotionally close to someone will harm his recovery. So he goes to a very young prostitute called Gary, who's David Morris, as you say. And of course, he completely fails to stay emotionally distant from him either. So it's really kind of, I mean, there is a story to it, but is it as shocking as it kind of is described? I mean, I saw the original, not the very first production. I think it actually came in and out of the West End a couple of times because it did a tour in between. And I think I saw it the second time. So it was a year or two old by the time I saw it, and even then I kind of felt like it wasn't as shocking as it thought it was, or as people had described it as. There are sexual elements to it, but a lot of what it's really about is the whole transaction side of it. I think it's actually been quite well matched here with Sean Holmes as director. Although he does do some things in different styles, he does particularly like to go back to this very European anti-naturalistic style, which is very literally messy. There's lots of people taking their clothes off and getting covered in food. Anytime you see any kind of Eastern European theatre, that's likely to happen, and it's just as likely to happen in a Sean Holmes production. And that is what we get here. There's a small amount of nudity and a certain amount of food getting used in unusual ways. I think it does match the show a bit better. I think You see, I can't remember details about the original production, but I think it was probably a bit more naturalistic than this. And I think this actually works better for it because it isn't a naturalistic show. And I think it brings out the comedy of it, the really kind of nasty, dark comedy of it, a lot better. I mean, there are some genuinely kind of upsetting things that happen in the story, and you know, the ending of Gary's story is really dark. But a lot of how it's played is, I suppose, it takes a lot of its aesthetic from the idea of a shopping channel. So there's kind of huge screens in the background, and there's a green screen which is used a lot. You get the actors on it a lot while you see kind of projected on the screens behind what where they're meant to be, or something more abstract, especially in the more drug related scenes. I'm still not really sure what I think of the play, and I mean, I've never been a huge fan of Mark Ravenhill. It's interesting to me that actually reviving one of his plays is very unusual. You often see kind of a new work from him, but very few people actually revive his older plays, which does make me question, you know, how much they've retained. But I think for me, I mean, I've looked around, and I think some reviews have thought that the kind of style of the production doesn't really do anything for it. I disagree. I think that the style of the production is kind of what brings it to life still. I'm not entirely sure it's as meaningful as people have thought or people have said it was in the first place. But it does have some interesting ideas. I'm not sure how well they hold together, but I think it's become kind of a much more successful evening here. And I think Sean Holmes has really honed in on the kind of idea of everything being a transaction. And it becomes, even before the show starts, during the show, there's kind of interludes. I mean, there's no interval, but there's little breaks. And the cast are constantly kind of genuinely trying to sell you stuff. They're trying to get more of your money for real, you know, it's not kind of, I'll borrow a fiver off you and get it back at the end of the show. I think it focuses really on what the themes are meant to be, because I think in that kind of style of production, the more shocking stuff is, it is a 20th anniversary production. So I think we have seen a lot of the stuff that was new then, we've seen since, become more common. So I think really the focus, I would say, is on the shopping more than the fucking, really, in the production, which I think is probably always the point. Yeah, so basically, I've never been completely convinced by it, but I know that some people do think it's kind of a modern masterpiece. But what do you think, Tim?
I wasn't really looking forward to this an awful lot. I saw it back, 19 years ago, so I saw it in the West End, where it had a much more West End and television-friendly cast. And, yeah, there was some vaguely shocking bits in that, and as you say, it was a rather more naturalistic. This one, they basically just all get down to their underpants very quickly and start flinging things like food around. They've all got price tags on them. So yes, it's all about the transaction. And oddly enough, I didn't find the sex scenes quite as, I think I was shocked 19 years ago. I can't remember enough, but you know, things like the rimming incident, which ends up with somebody spitting blood out, and the possible rape of one of the characters, which happens later. And I do remember that being rather more vicious in the first one. This one, it almost seems like fun in some cases. I mean, certainly Gary, who is a victim, is a much more tragic figure, I felt, in this production. But there is a sort of a lightheartedness about this. It all feels kind of fun. There's no bite to this production, I think. And that might be why some of the reviewers have been a bit sniffy about it. Certainly on the night I went, we had a very young audience in, lots of teenagers, and they were loving it. And certainly it's a play that allows for quite a lot of interaction. And there's quite a lot of times where you're expected to volunteer, you're expected to buy things, and can get a little bit worried, and especially when they start, you know, putting cameras around and trying to focus on people. That's always a little bit dangerous if you don't particularly want to hang around on the stage. But for all that, I think what it pointed out for me is that I'm not absolutely certain that this play's any good. It's got a shocking title, and at the time, all the things they showed were shocking, but the play itself, I'm not sure it still has the capacity to shock. That might be because we've, as a society, we've gone further and further down the drain, but it might also be that we got over ourselves and, and just grew up a little and can cope with these ideas. I mean, I seem to remember some scenes 19 years ago which I found shocking, and I no longer find them shocking in any way. And that's partially to do with the production, which, as I said, has a slightly light tone to it. And I did have one or two problems with some of the casting. I mean, principally, I think Sam Spruill as Mark, initially I didn't buy him as somebody who would own his boyfriend and girlfriend. I didn't feel that at all. I didn't feel him really as a drug addict, possibly because he did quite a lot of intro into the play and, you know, broke the fourth wall and chatted to everybody just before the play started, and it was a bit of a mismatch initially. And I did feel that he got much more into character later on. I was able to accept his character much more later on, but initially I was a bit bothered by him. He didn't seem to fit in the play. He just didn't look or feel right. But I think I enjoyed my evening here, and especially as the people all around me were having a whale of a time. They were obviously seeing something that they were having enormous fun with. I don't think I enjoyed it as much. I don't think the play really stood up, but it's an interesting take on the play, and I think it's sort of actually, in the end, a good way of doing this play. I don't think it would work quite so well if they had done it straight and naturalistic as the earlier productions might have been. We're now going to talk about The Tempest, which is the Donmar Theatre's production at King's Cross Theatre. This is part of a Shakespeare trilogy directed by Phyllida Lloyd, designed by Chloe Lamford, where they are setting three Shakespeare plays in a prison environment. They've done this before with the plays Henry IV and Julius Caesar at the sort of the main Donmar, but they've now expanded it to a trilogy and added The Tempest to the repertoire. The other thing about these productions have been that they use an all-female cast, and they are led by Harriet Walter. Other members of the cast include Jada Nuka, Jackie Clune, Martina Laird, Sophie Stanton. I'm missing out a whole load of other names, which probably should be mentioned. Claire Dundee, Harvey. I probably should have named everybody. But it seems to be an interesting experiment, although I personally never liked the prison setting. I didn't get on with it, and certainly didn't get on with the chairs that they used at the Donmar. John, tell me more about this production, what you thought of it.
It's hard to know where to start because there's so much I don't like, and I really like The Tempest. It's one of my favourite Shakespeare plays. But I think that the rule for Shakespeare 101 is that you can muck about with it all you like because the poor sod's well out of copyright. But isn't the acid test for any modern rendering, if you hadn't seen this play before, would this production tell you the story? And for the Donmar King's Cross all-girl Tempest, I'm afraid the answer is a big, fat no. I was going in thinking what a wonderful box they've created here, and you know the whole sort of environment around the King's Cross Granary yard is delicious. It's it used to be horrible, and it's become a really attractive pedestrian precinct. And I'm saying to myself, oh, brave new shed that hath such people in it. And then after it had taken them 37 minutes to get the audience into the grandstand seating, I was a little bit less excited. But you know, everything's shiny and new, and everyone's very friendly, which is interesting for Fringe Theatre audiences and makes a very good first impression. And you know, I popped the top of my canned gin and tonic from Marks and Spencer's across the road during the storm, so it didn't disturb anybody. I was then very pleasantly surprised that nobody rustled a sweet or consulted a phone or ate a bag of crisps for the next 2 hours. But. Setting it in a women's prison, I mean, it's such an exhausted, enervated trope. And it struck me that this was, not only was it just like the shouty staging of some Hackney Girls Comprehensive School, as though some supply teacher thought, oh, hang on, it says Prospero's Cell in the script. There's an idea that won't stretch the budget. But having done it already with Richard and Julius Caesar, it's like she's in her third year of desperation with this suggestion that somehow The Tempest, for its island setting, suits an isolated prison and the isolation of the prison. It's just too trite and too easy, and it's been done to death. So I expected better of Phyllida Lloyd and certainly better of the Donmar. There is luxurious casting, no doubt about it. And this is a virtuous enterprise. You know, I don't want to knock the ideas of building the shed up at King's Cross, and particularly not because they have donated 25% of the seats to people who wouldn't otherwise go to the theatre, you know, reaching out to community and school and youth groups in order to involve more people. And those young people did seem engaged with what was happening. But whether they saw The Tempest or not, I really don't like to say. So you have, as I say, luxurious casting. Harriet Walter, you know, how wonderful she can be. Remember, you know, in Death of a Salesman recently at Stratford, she just turned more out of Linda Lohman than I've ever seen anybody else do before. And she looks amazing, you know, rocking a wife beater vest at 66. But I found her Prospero interesting, but very hesitant. And it was almost as if she didn't know the lines, which she must do because they've been doing this quite a long time. So as a central force, she is the centre, but not the force of the production, if that makes sense. And Philidor has surrounded her by, you know, what at best you have to describe as a series of knockabout comic turns. You've got a Mutton Jeff double act of Jackie Clune and Karen Dunbar playing Stefano and Trinculo as though they were end of the pier music hall comedians. And Sophie Stanton, who comes on as a kind of lumpen bag lady with a sort of skull cap on her head. And for a moment, you kind of evoke the shade of Victoria Wood, which would be a very good thing, but it does nothing to illuminate the character of Caliban. If it's about anything, The Tempest is about redemption, and that's redemption not just for Prospero, who's renouncing his magic, her magic, and you could concede that a prison term might be said to give the character the same sort of headspace to reform and recant as his exile to an Illyrian island. But also, the story brings important life changes to Ferdinand, Miranda, Antonio and Caliban. And, you know, in tracky bottoms and trainers and trailing strings of old milk cartons and their estuary accents, well, for me, they just didn't seem to make any kind of dramatic journey. It felt very empty. There's no lyricism in the verse speaking. It is made as conversational as humanly possible, which is obviously a deliberate ploy by Lloyd. But it deprives the piece of any romanticism or any magic, and there is precious little magic, apart from one moment where I thought James Farncombe's lighting, which is mostly very harsh, just collided with the direction beautifully for a moment. I think it's in the "We are such stuff as dreams are made on and our little lives are rounded with a sleep" speech, where they have projections of sort of beautiful and romantic places onto really, really large white balloons. And then Prospero takes a knitting needle or a craft knife and deflates them. And I thought, oh yeah, right, Harriet, you've let the balloons down. But you've let the side down as well. It just, the whole thing just did not gel for me. And I am no stranger to the idea that cross-gender casting is fine in Shakespeare, because 400 years ago, Will himself obviously cast all his plays, including The Tempest, with an all-male company. And, you know, only slightly more recently, I was Miranda when we did it at school. But I didn't like this version.
Nick, what did you think?
I certainly felt it was the weakest of the three productions. I was definitely surprised when I heard that it was going to be The Tempest. I mean, there'd been this kind of theme in the first two of people going around with kind of red gloves and red hands in somewhere or other. So I was quite convinced that they'd intended that Beth to be the last one. But I think it sounds as if kind of Phyllida Lloyd had this idea in her head of, I want to do a comedy, a tragedy and a history, and she'd obviously already done the tragedy and the history. So I suppose if you're looking to do a comedy, there's not many that would really fit this setting. And as you say, I mean, it does have a lot of references to cells, and you know, it is people kind of imprisoned. I think the first time that we hear about Ariel having been initially trapped in a tree for 12 years, and there's kind of a physical thing that Jada Nuka does to reflect that, and that becomes kind of a signature piece, that she's always kind of got that little movement sequence coming in that reminds us that she was imprisoned in a small place for a long time. So I can see why, if you were going to go for a comedy, you were going to go for this one. Where I agree absolutely is that it's not really a production of The Tempest, and I agree that if you came in not knowing the story, you would go out not knowing the story, because there's been a few cast changes over the course of the years since we had the first Julius Caesar, but Harriet Walters stayed with it throughout, and she's kind of been playing larger characters and kind of more significant characters as it's gone along. And there's kind of a through story in the three productions of her character, who, I mean, with this now, she kind of comes in and introduces herself as this prisoner called Hannah, who's in for life with the no hope of parole. And this is a lot more the kind of culmination of this story going on in the background than it is The Tempest itself. And I think, I mean, for me, by far the most successful of the trilogy was the Henry IV. I think it might partly be because Julius Caesar, I was quite disappointed when I heard about the play within a play element, because I actually, when I heard that it was going to be Julius Caesar in a women's prison, I kind of thought, well, played straight, that perfectly works, you know, just transposing it into a women's prison, you know, all the wars as a kind of prison riot and that sort of thing. I could totally see that. So I was a bit disappointed that they were actually doing something else than that. But with Henry IV, which doesn't as automatically lend itself, because they did it as the play within a play, I thought it worked very well, because I think they managed to mix actually telling the story with the kind of backstory they'd created for the prisoner characters very well in the Henry IV. Then you had the similarity between the Falstaff and Hal relationship and the fact that one of the prisoners was getting out soon, and you got a lot of this without it overwhelming the play. I think, although there was a lot I liked about this, I probably enjoyed this more than John did, but I would definitely say it's not really a production of The Tempest, and it's overwhelmed by the prison story. I mean, to the point where, because it's really Hannah the prisoner's story rather than Prospero's, we get a change to the ending. Prospero doesn't get to leave the island because Hannah the prisoner doesn't. I don't necessarily mind changing things like that for good reason, but it demonstrates, I think, the fact that the story they've created for the characters has become more important to the creatives than actually telling the story of The Tempest. Also, I'm not a huge fan of The Tempest, so I don't mind it as much that it's kind of been messed around with as John does, but I think it's quite an interesting evening. The thing is, I mean, I don't think the critics have been invited in yet, because they've not quite reopened to hop. I think they're probably waiting until they revive the first two and do these trilogy days, and that's what they're going to invite the critics in for.
The 22nd.
Yeah, but, well, I mean, I saw this a couple of weeks ago, and, you know, so we're talking about it's another month before that. So we are looking at the vast majority of people are probably going to just see this one. And, you know, like I say, I saw At the Donmar the first time around, both the other two plays. So I've seen the through line of it, but the majority of people are just going to see this. So I think the fact that the through line of the new characters that have been created has become more important in this production than the play itself is going to be even more problematic for people, whether they know the Tempest or not, if they haven't seen the other two productions, if, you know, the vast majority. And obviously this is a bigger capacity, so there are going to be people, not just the people getting free tickets, which actually the Donmar aren't actually donating those tickets. They are requesting that other audience members pay for them. But, you know, they won't be the only people who just see that, because, you know, there'll be a lot of people who couldn't get into the first two because of capacity who will be able to get into this one. So for a lot of people, this is going to be the only one they see. And I think it's probably even more problematic there that this is just the story of the people in the prison. So, yeah, I can't say I didn't enjoy it, but I would agree it's not The Tempest.
We're now going to talk about The Red Barn by David Hare at the Littleton Theatre, part of the National Theatre. This play is adapted from Georges Simenon's 1968 novel Le Mans. Georges Simenon is probably best known for Inspector Maigret and probably not wanting you to think about his time in the Second World War. I think he was kind of on the losing side there in some ways. This production stars Mark Strong, Hope Davis, Elizabeth Debicki, along with Nigel Whitmey, Stuart Milligan, Oliver, Alvin Wilson, Michael Elwin, Anna Skellen, and Jay Durrell. It concerns a man called Donald Dodd, a lawyer who has feelings for his best friend's wife and is at a party, is so incensed by what he sees his best friend doing that when they return home in a snowstorm, he allows his best friend to get lost. This production is directed by Robert Icke, with a design by Bunny Christie and lighting designer Paul Constable. It's done in a fairly cinematic style. We have some quite short filmic scenes, and we also have shutters that move around and enclose the action and cause vignettes on various scenes and open out the play in different ways to show different aspects of the play. So it has a filmic scene, and lots of people have talked about Alfred Hitchcock when they talk about this play, and of course, because it's set in the late 60s, they talk about Don Draper from the TV series Mad Men. I have to say, when I watched it, I thought quite a lot about Patricia Highsmith, but then I've read a lot of Patricia Highsmith rather than everyone else who's only just read Talented Mr. Ripley. Phil, what did you think about this play, and tell me more about it?
It begins sort of in a way, a bit like an Agatha Christie. I mean, you've got three people literally stranded. They're snowed in this, as this blizzard rages outside. You see them struggling to get to the house, and you don't really know what's happened because one of the people has gone missing. And then what sort of unfolds is in sort of flashbacks initially, and then what happens subsequently. So we sort of go backwards and forwards, but it's all quite straightforward. As you say, the design of it is absolutely stunning, I thought. I mean, it's very filmic. The aperture closing like a camera and folding in almost on a tiny little speck of a scene, which very open up on one of the reveals, which you've already revealed, was very cleverly done as the black sort of flat moved across and you see the other side of the stage, which was a bit sort of like Rear Window in a sense, in the way that you were sort of seeing this occurrence. And also I think the sort of the Agatha Christie-ish element kind of disappears, because it's actually more about a psychological kind of thriller and why Donald Dodd would, I'm trying not to give anything away, would become the person that he sort of later becomes in the play. The problem I had with it, even though I was very engaged by it and I think it looked absolutely stunning and the sound effects and lighting is great, was the measured, very, very measured delivery in which the cast give it. It's a bit like a David Mamet in a sense, particularly the David Mamet film House of Cards. Almost everybody speaks at the same level, at the same speed, and sort of rather lifelessly, which I thought actually impeded the play. It was obviously a very deliberate thing, because even when the police inspector turns up and questions them, he's sort of talking in the same way. And I think particularly Elizabeth Debicki, who kind of has this very kind of, she's incredibly tall, she's quite stunning, she is quite sort of the archetypal Hitchcock kind of blonde. She's absolutely cool. I mean, very sort of like a Grace Kelly or a Tippi Hedren. And you really don't know what is going on behind her. When you see her smile, it's quite a relief, which is very rarely. Mark Strong, I felt kind of his wig and his glasses, it does make him look very not like Mark Strong, but I still felt his charisma was under there. But that's perhaps because I know who he is. Perhaps other people might think he's absolutely brilliant as a very dull lawyer. But I think it's quite gripping. I was entertained. It's great that it's done in about an hour and three quarters with no interval. I think it would absolutely kill it if they'd broken for an interval. But I just had a problem with the pace of it. And there's a sort of a clock ticking on the set at one point, and it was almost as though they were being measured by the clock like a metronome. It was just, I just found that really spoiled it for me.
Nick, what did you think?
I didn't have so much a problem with the pacing of it. I thought, actually, the measured delivery thing that everybody was doing, that's one of the things that also seemed to be a particular kind of Hitchcock reference. I thought the production came across better than the play, to be honest, because, as you say, at some point it sort of stops being this thriller and becomes, I don't know that I'd even call it a psychological thriller, because it is more of a character study. And I think the trouble is, I wasn't that interested in the characters. I thought there's a crossover somewhere between enigmatic and just not really very well developed, and I think they were aiming for one and kind of got the other. I think where the production is really clever is that it actually took me a while to realise that we were just kind of looking at a character study. And like I say, I think that might have worked better if I'd cared more about the characters. But it actually took me a while to realise, because it's so stylishly done that it feels like you're still kind of in the thriller, even when really you're not. But I do think that was my problem with it, really. I wasn't convinced by the character study that is kind of the ultimate point. It's probably not down to the original book, because, you know, I've heard it described as a novella, so it's presumably fairly short, but still would have had a lot more time to kind of develop the characters. Are certainly the central character, who I think I've seen mentioned was the narrator in the book, so it's possibly down to how Hare's adapted it. Like I say, I think the production, and I mean Bonnie Christie's design, it's kind of doing that thing of, because we've seen so many shows of the Littleton with really impressive set changes, and we know kind of some of the mechanics of that stage, I think you can probably guess how some of those set changes are done. But they are so quick. You get like 30 seconds of darkness with like a phone call playing over it, and then it pans out sort of in this film style effect, and you get completely different setup and some really huge looking stages in some cases. So it's very visually impressive, and I think very interestingly directed. But I don't think it didn't feel like a wasted evening to me, but it was disappointing in terms of what it was ultimately going for. I think the real point of it was this character study, and unfortunately I thought that was the weakest part of the writing.
Gareth, what did you think?
Well, I think my problem with it is that it's a thriller that's not particularly thrilling, really, and it's one of its strong points, which is the design, actually is what hijacks it in the end. Because, you know, it is brilliantly designed by Bonnie Christie, but the reality is that all these set changes mean you're looking at the blank screen quite a lot, and it's not so much the speed of them, because some of them, as Nick says, are really quick and very clever, but there's just so many of them, really. And I just felt I was looking at this blank screen, and it was taking away from me the pace, it was taking away from me any sort of thrilling aspects of it, and that was the fundamental flaw in it. And each of the components are excellent, you know, you can't really, I mean, I thought it was well written. I liked the design, I liked the staging, I thought the soundscape was great, I liked the lighting, I thought the acting was really good, particularly Mark Strong and Elizabeth Debicki. So all of the components to me were well crafted, but when you add them all up together, it didn't work as well as it should have worked, because it wasn't thrilling enough, because of the pace, and that was because of some of the components. I think the point about the speech is interesting, because I felt the speech was being purposefully very film noir. They made that choice, and in a way that kind of also contributes to its lack of success when you put everything together, really. And sometimes it even sounded a bit tongue-in-cheek, which seemed a bit odd for a psychological thriller. That sort of also seemed a bit odd, really. I was in the middle of the front row, and for once, this was actually kind of pole position for this show. I felt very happy where I was sitting. But the other problem with this design is I suspect people dotted around other parts of the theatre would miss things, because, you know, sometimes you have a small aperture on one side of the stage, which people in the opposite side of the auditorium, particularly at the front, wouldn't see. So I do think there were sightline issues as well with the design. But overall, I think that, you know, great, great components, but ultimately they don't add up to more than the parts, and that's largely down to the pacing, which is in itself down to the design and the staging. So I admired it. I didn't feel it was a wasted evening, but I felt it could have been, you know, it could have been a lot more thrilling than it actually was.
I agree with both of you. I think it wasn't a wasted evening at all, but I did have problems, and I agree, I didn't really care about them enough to care what actually happened. One thing about the staging, and I do agree with you about the sightline things, I was in, I think, the second row, not quite in the centre, but we did have problems. It took a while sometimes for you to actually see the scene because the aperture was so small, and if you're sitting at the side, and there would have been moments, I think, if you were on the extreme sides, the front, where it would have been way too long before you actually saw the scene. You would have heard the action going on, but you would have just seen a wall or something because of the angle that you're at. But one other thing about the the main house set, which is sort of the first big set that we see, I don't know if anybody notices, but each time we return to that, did anybody else notice it was moving slightly to the left each time?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, no, I noticed that.
Yeah, it was, which I thought was quite clever, because at first I thought I was imagining it, and then I actually checked because, for instance, the portrait of the family, the photograph, I could see all of it in the first time, and the next time I thought, well, I can't see that very well now because the angle I'm at, and then it was completely out of my vision the third time I saw the set. So I thought it was quite interesting to do that shift, which sort of made you feel a bit uneasy and made you question what you were seeing, which I think was obviously a deliberate thing about questioning what you were seeing, because it's that. There was that sort of thing going on about the lawyer's wife's, Hope Davis's character, sort of, which begins with her and the opticians, and she's actually this all-seeing person and doesn't miss anything, which was kind of a little bit overdone.
I mean, the thing about the sort of mystery, even after, and it's very difficult to talk about, but even after the initial mystery is kind of solved, it still has surprises up its sleeve. So I think that I did like the fact that it still actually surprised you after what you might have thought would have been the main event, as it were. That sounds terrible now, but I'm trying not to say any more, I suppose.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.